We've entered a realm of strange-sounding abbreviations like BHT, BHA, and EDTA, and even stranger-sounding terms like carrageenan and sodium lauryl sulfate. You've entered a dimension not only of sight and sound, but of chemicals. At that signpost up ahead, your next stop, the grocery store.
All right, good morning, Sandy Springs and the surrounding Atlanta area. You're listening to Inside the Black Box here on 1620 AM, Radio Sandy Springs. I'm Pete Ludovis, one of your co-hosts, along with my co-host, Bill Hunt. How you doing, Bill?
Good.
So, Bill, today we're going to take on chemicals in the grocery store. Does this cause you any pause or trepidation?
Oh, I think it's, I've been wondering for years what's in Velveeta.
I believe only the Nuclear Regulatory Commission knows what's in Velveeta.
Yeah, I'm just disturbed by the cheese-like product, you know, kind of.
Absolutely. I think American cheese is actually an oxymoron for those of you that have ever visited Europe and actually attempted or tried cheese over there. So today we're going to look at chemicals, and let me just give the disclaimer at the outset of the show that if you're like me and you're a geek and you sit and read the ingredient labels on consumer products, and of course subsequently have no social life because of that, it's very confusing. And the truth is, it's only slightly less confusing for engineers, scientists, and even our guest, Professor Larry Bottomley, who's a chemist in the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry at Georgia Tech, because the naming conventions are non-standard. What they like to use is very systematic naming nomenclature from the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemists. And, in fact, there are a lot of trade names, common names, and one of the things we'll see in the second 10 minutes is that there are numerous names for even common things you might find in food or consumer products. Before we get started with the topic of chemicals and chemistry in the grocery store, let's just do a little recapping from previous shows. So, for example, 2 weeks ago, we did talk about robotics competitions, and I noticed, I believe it was last Wednesday, in the New York Times, this was actually published April 26th, in an article by Nina Bernstein about a young East Harlem high school student who was in one of the finals for one of these robotics competitions, was on his way down to Atlanta for a robotics competition this very week. In Atlanta, Georgia, and that's when they realized that this young student is obviously very bright because he's a senior who was on one of the winning teams that was coming down to Atlanta, was in fact an illegal alien. So right now he's in immigration limbo. He's from Senegal and had no ID that would enable him to board the plane. So it's really going to depend on whether or not we end up with immigration law based on the Senate bill or the House bill, one of which would declare him instantly a felon, and one might actually have a path for him to become a U.S. citizen. And the reason I threw this in is we're right in the middle of immigration discussions, immigration law turmoil, and this is actually quite relevant to science and the scientists that have, you know, done things that were absolutely terrific in this country. So I'm reminded of the fact that much of the scientific acumen we have here in this country was imported. So we've got a lot of great homegrown scientists, but not only did folks like Enrico Fermi and Albert Einstein come over here from Europe at or around World War II, and maybe, Bill, you have an issue with this as well. We are kind of the graduate school to the world.
Right.
And a lot of students come over here from foreign countries. They go to graduate school, and people think, well, why are we training all these folks? Truth is, many of them end up staying here and working
right.
for our companies. So,
right. We've always had the policy of being open to these foreign students. There may be something in the structure of education in the States versus England as well, as terms of how inviting it might be to someone from outside.
Right. I think the biggest problem a lot of us have is it's not so inviting anymore. So, for example, the visa restrictions, trying to get an H-1 visa for a postdoc I had just last year, very, very difficult. In fact, one of my students that was a PhD student graduated, was working for AMD, the microprocessor company, went to India to visit his father for a couple of weeks, and even AMD, with all its lawyers, couldn't keep track of all the new regulations, and he was stuck there for 3 weeks.
I've got a better one. I've got, I had a French graduate student, and he had thought he was straight with the immigration people, and this was when the when French fries became freedom fries, and he went to give a talk on his master's thesis work in Japan. They wouldn't let him back into the country. He had a minor drug possession charge in Georgia, and he can never re-enter the U.S. again. And you know, it's a something I use with my kids, like, don't even do this. So the guy can never go back to the United States for a conference or anything else, and he's French.
Wow.
You know, what are they going to do, like, give you a good bottle of wine or something like that?
And what did this
or?
Do for your research project?
Well, it was just ground it to a halt. I mean, the thing he was working on just had to, it was just very abruptly stopped, and he couldn't get back into the country.
So let's actually turn to our mailbag this morning. We have another email from possibly our biggest fan now. This would be Professor Paul Neitzel. From the mechanical engineering department.
It's more hate mail. Our hate
No,
mail,
actually yeah. not. So Paul tries to listen to the show whenever he can, and basically he said, if you read the first part of his email, that what was it? One of his colleagues said, "Nice job." They were very impressed with our level of preparedness, which is in stark contrast to what did he call us 2 weeks ago? We sucked. Something like that.
Yeah.
So he did point out at the bottom here that his lawyer will be in contact with us about the continuous Paul Neitzel bashing. And, of course, Paul, we're just kidding. You know we love you. We think you're a fabulous human being.
Well, we never accused him of being a human being. Go ahead.
True, but fabulous nonetheless. Yes, yeah. But he also points out that in our talk on robotics 2 weeks ago, where we put a link to this first Lego robotics competition, points out putting a link to a $200 Lego toy on your website is presupposing an affluent audience for your show. And actually, it's closer to 250, and for once, I agree with Paul. So I'm looking into getting this, ordering this from the Lego catalog for my kids. And 250 for Georgia Tech faculty who haven't had more than about a 1% average raise in the last 4 to 6 years. Our guest, Professor Bottomley, is chiming in on that one. 250 is a lot. So I think one of the things we're going to do is I'm talking with Dennis Sanol, who was with us a couple weeks ago, about trying to find some cheaper things. The Capsella system is a really neat sort of robotic.
Well, the other thing, too, but in the context of the LEGO League and the teams, it's 250 is not too much if you've got a group of people, but for everybody, I'm not going to go out and pay 250 for my kid to have that, but for a team to work on it, it's fine.
So, and to that end, the other piece of equipment you need for those robotics kits is a computer to program it. So I did notice in this morning's New York Times, an interesting article by Joe Nocera, about Nicholas Negroponte, who was sort of the first cyber evangelist, and he had a premier column in Wired magazine for many, many years. He was the director of the Media Lab at MIT. This was after Bill's and my time there. Do you remember the Media Lab?
It hadn't started when I was there, but Jay Lim, one of my professors, was one of the original founders.
So I remember they built it when I was a graduate student right outside the chemical engineering building there, and it was all white porcelain with a giant sort of slat sticking out of there. We called it the outdoor toilet because it looked like that was a toilet paper holder or something like that. One nice thing, though, is Nick Negroponte is actually working on a project with AMD and Quanta Computer Corporation to produce $100 computers. So hopefully by the year 2007, where he's going to begin production on that, at least the computer will be inexpensive. We've got to take a break right now, and when we come back, we'll be talking to our guest, Professor Larry Bottomley from Georgia Tech. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on 1620 AM, Radio Sandy Springs.
Water, propylene, glycol, mysterious, mysterious day.
So, welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on 1620 AM. If what you thought you were listening to sounded like Latin in a Gregorian chant, in fact, it was a Gregorian chant of the ingredients of baby lotion. And that underscores the fact that to most people, chemical names sound like Latin. We're here with our guest, Professor Larry Bottomley from the School of Chemistry and Biochemistry. At Georgia Tech, Dr. Bottomley received his B.S. and Ph.D. degrees from, well, good morning, Larry. I was going to give you the big intro first, okay. Make you sound much more impressive than the schleppy guy sitting here in the Hawaiian shirt.
This is radio, not
that's
TV.
That's the good thing about radio.
Yes.
So Dr. Bottomley received his BS and PhD degrees respectively from Cal State University Fullerton and the University of Houston respectively. He teaches and does research in the field of analytical chemistry, and actually his research activities include advanced methods in atomic force microscopy, and he also does applications with myself and other collaborators at Georgia Tech to carbon nanotubes and works on DNA complexes. So good morning, Larry.
Good morning, Pete.
Okay, so I mentioned before in the first 10 minutes that it's not only difficult for the average person to understand all these bizarre chemical names, it's difficult even for chemists, right?
Agreed.
And it's difficult because of all the different names for common chemicals, correct?
Correct.
And you've got a couple common names for very simple things, right?
Yeah. For example, the chemist might look at a molecule known as dihydrogen oxide, and the rest of the planet refers to it as water or ice. Then there's also the confusing part about something simple as salt, readily available in the grocery store in a variety of forms. We can buy salt, we can buy rock salt, we can buy sea salt, we can buy kosher salt. The chemist knows this is sodium chloride. Labeling is everything. Another example might be vitamin B1. The consumer will likely pick up the bottle of vitamin B1, look at the label, convinced it's a vitamin and therefore must be healthy and good for them, and walk away with the product. But you can buy the same chemical at a chemical supplier, and it might be known as thiamine or 3,4-amino-2-methyl-5-pyridinamino-methyl-5-hydroxyethyl-4-methylchloride.
Gesundheit.
The pharmacist might look at it and go, that's nothing simple, nothing more than apatite drape, or methiamine, or thiacote thiamine.
Right.
How do you make sense of all this?
So that really nasty one, that was the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemists nomenclature, the IUPAC nomenclature, right?
Yes.
Okay. And that's the really precise one. That's the one that when you listen to it, not me, because I barely scraped through organic chemistry, you know, it's got all the numbers that tell you where the methyl and the chloral is.
It tells you exactly the arrangement of each individual atom of an element in the molecule.
And the other thing about IUPAC is this is an organization that chemists all over the world, regardless of where they are, can speak the same language.
In theory.
In theory.
Yes.
But there's still sort of variations.
There can be because of that name I just read. It takes, you know, several minutes to get through. And so even among chemists, you adopt shorthand. Common names, common
right. Like
chemical
subgroups, if they work with it quite a bit, they'll...
Right. Mm-hmm. So in polymer chemistry where we work, we come up with common names just so we can communicate with people. And we'll say, that's the chloro-substituted one with a chlorine on it. But the problem is you go to write the paper, and the paper goes to an American Chemical Society journal, and you are required to figure out what that IUPAC name is. And you try to avoid putting in the title, because if you do, the title's like 8 lines long.
Right.
Because of
and another thing there, too, it's not like you go to a dictionary and it tells you what the name is. There's a methodology for it. So you can go from looking at the name and draw the structure, or you can go from the structure to what the name is. So there's a sort of set procedure there that you can figure it out as opposed to having to memorize all this.
The average listener is going to be confused at this point. Why do we care? It's because there are several chemicals which are comprised of exactly the same elements in exactly the same proportions, but it's only the local arrangement of those atoms of each element that give rise to different properties.
Right.
As you and I were talking about this in the prep for the show, you know, it's why is it we can have one molecule that has ostensibly the same elemental composition as sugar, and yet it doesn't taste sweet.
Right.
Right.
So there are literally dozens of these six-membered rings with carbon in and one oxygen in the backbone and a lot of hydroxyls.
Yeah.
They have exactly the same composition, and they have completely different properties.
Right.
Right. So, you know, what you know is glucose, fructose, maltose, galactose, all these are very similar compounds.
Yes.
Right. So We need to take a break in just a second here, but before we do, you claim that the biggest vendor of chemicals in the world is what?
The grocery store.
Right. But everybody goes into the grocery store, and people are terrified of chemicals. I mean, are we going to cause people not to go to the grocery store anymore?
No. Everything is comprised of chemicals in one form or another.
Okay.
So solids, liquids, gases.
So when I hear the term chemical-free, that's a bit of a misnomer.
It's more than a misnomer.
Okay.
It's insanity.
So exactly how much of a misnomer? So how insane
that
is?
The only chemical-free environment you have is a vacuum.
Okay.
Deep space.
And that's what we're going to tackle when we get back in just a minute. Once again, you're listening to Inside the Black Box on 1620 AM, Radio Sandy Springs, web and podcasting at RadioSandySprings.com. Welcome back to Inside the Black Box on 1620 AM, Radio Sandy Springs. Bill and I are here with our guest, Professor Larry Bottomley, an analytical chemist from Georgia Tech. Now, we just mentioned that the grocery store is perhaps the biggest distributor of chemicals in the world. So where does one find chemicals in the grocery store?
On every single aisle, on every item. In fact, even the shelving themselves are comprised of chemicals.
Indeed.
Yes. So I went cruising through the closest grocery store to my home last night and just made a very short list of the pure chemicals, or relatively pure forms of the chemicals, that one might be able to buy. For example, aluminum foil. Not only a pure chemical, it's an element,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you look at the piece of aluminum foil, it'll have a small amounts of silicon and iron, a little bit of oxygen stuck around it, but by and large, it's comprised of a single element throughout. Other chemicals found at the grocery store in relatively pure form include, as I mentioned before, salt substitute, baking soda, washing soda, cane sugar, vinegar, dry ice, bleach, lye, borax. If you drift over to the aisle where the pharmaceuticals are, then you have rubbing alcohol, Epsom salts, aspirin.
Right.
Those are the common names. We can have the IUPAC name, which will take us the rest of the show if we read through those.
Right.
But the chemical name, the shorthand chemical name that everyone knows them by, let's see, water, dihydrogen oxide, salt, sodium chloride, salt substitute, potassium chloride, vinegar, acetic acid, cane sugar, sucrose, ammonia, sodium hydroxide, sodium borate, hydrogen peroxide, magnesium sulfate, Epsom salts, and finally, acetylsalicylic acid.
Right.
These are just a small fraction of the chemicals that you can buy. The majority of the chemicals in the grocery store are mixtures. Mixtures of chemicals that are good for you, mixtures of chemicals that are inert and passed directly through your pipes.
All right,
into the receptacle.
Let's explain a few. So inert means exactly what to the layperson?
No nutritional value.
Right.
Okay. Oh, well, inert in a general chemical sense means it doesn't interact.
Right.
It
doesn't react, right.
Right.
Right. So it's just all by itself.
It's just there. It's just on the bus, Charleway's bus, riding through town. It's
right.
Not doing anything with anything.
Right? And that's the whole logic behind artificial sweeteners, is you find yourself a molecule that is sort of shaped and arranged much like sucrose or fructose, such that it activates this taste receptor on your tongue, yet it doesn't get broken down into its requisite food value, which, of course, sugars, which are carbohydrates, do.
The pretty remarkable thing about some of the sugar substitutes is that their structures are very different, their chemical structures, the arrangement of the atoms in the molecule. There is no similarity in the structure of saccharin, sodium cyclamate, or aspartame. The only one that has a similarity in structure is sucralose. It's similar in structure to sucrose, the cane sugar that we buy, with the substitution or with the added placement of one chlorine atom in the molecule. Two chlorine atoms in the molecule. And that simple exchange of chlorine for other atoms in the molecule renders that active to the taste buds, but totally unreactive as it passes through your digestive system.
You just said chlorine, didn't you?
Yes.
Isn't the average person alarmed by chlorine? I'm looking over at Robin. Robin indicates, yes, we're alarmed by chlorine. So why is it that sometimes we should be worried about chlorine and other times we shouldn't?
It's a case of reading the fine print, paying careful attention not only to the first syllable in chlorine, but also to the letters at the end. You can have chlorine, you can have chloride, you can have chlorite, perchlorate, hypochlorite, etc. And the reason the ending of these words change is because the chemical structure and the chemical reactivity is changing as well. And so it's code to the chemist on what materials are safe and what materials are reactive.
Right. So, for example, chloride, the ion, exists in large amounts, right, in the human body.
It's essential for life.
Right. Absolutely. Whereas if you were to look at things like chlorine, you don't want tons and tons of chlorine floating around the human body, but we use chlorine in purification processes, right?
Right. And so most of the folks in this country are keenly aware of the use of chlorine gas in World War I as a chemical warfare agent. What they're not familiar with is the common use of bubbling chlorine gas through water to make hypochlorite bleach.
Right. Right. And anyone that complains about bleach, if you've eaten white bread your whole life, we essentially use very similar compounds to bleach flour that same way. My wife's one of these health freaks. We've never had white bread in our house the entire time I've been married to her. But
you probably got a stash in a closet. She
right.
Know
right.
About
Wonder
white bread.
Bread.
Stuff. Yeah, yeah. Where'd this come from?
Hidden behind the toilet.
Right.
So that brings us to another important point that, we think of bleach. And obviously you would not recommend somebody going, grabbing the Clorox bottle and mixing with a little tonic water and swimming with
No.
Right. Yet, bleach is used in our drinking water. It's used in a lot of things, but in a much lower concentration.
Yes.
Right? And isn't that an interesting point, that the dosage or the concentration matters?
Yes.
Right. So
the chemical we know as dihydrogen oxide, water, is toxic. If you get enough of it, you will no longer survive.
Right.
Right. And you can, by getting enough of it, it means two different ways. One is ingestion or immersion.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So
can I back up and maybe explain a few things? So if we're throwing around atoms and elements and all this other kind of stuff, just briefly to explain that. So all these the elements, there are 106, or the people at Berkeley stopped creating new elements back in the 60s, Einsteinium, all these other fun things.
Right.
But these are all comprised of protons, neutrons, and electrons, and they have different sizes, and they interact in different kind of ways. And you start putting those together like Lego building blocks to build bigger structures called molecules. And what's really intriguing is that, so when you think of it, you've built this Lego structure. These sugars have similar, the structures are similar, but they're not exactly the same. And so then you can have, chlorine where, what would be a good substitute for chlorine?
So bromine.
Sodium or, not sodium, but. But anyway, so think of it, you got the building blocks of the elements, the Lego thing goes together, and what that final structure looks like, that'll interact with you, your body, in a different way than something that's got the same atoms in it, but made in a different configuration to look like a different Lego thing.
Right. That's what keeps me in business, because it's the way in which these elements and atoms are arranged.
Mm.
There's a whole study, a sub-study in chemistry, about whether the molecule is put together by a person who's left-handed versus right-handed.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly enough, the reactivity of a molecule put together by a left-handed individual is completely different than the one that's put together by right-handed. I'm not suggesting that we make molecules by hand, just that I'm referring to the arrangement around.
Right. There's this inherent symmetry in molecules, and what you'll find is the vast majority of molecules in the human body are left-handed. So
yes,
we often call Mother Nature
Latin for sinister.
Indeed. We often call Mother Nature left-handed, and when you do the right-handed one, it's either completely inert or has unexpected consequences once in a while. And we'll continue with that discussion of molecular symmetry. Can I say that, Bill?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Molecular symmetry here when we come back from the break on Inside the Black Box, 1620 AM, Radio Sandy Springs. We're back on Inside the Box. Inside the Black Box, I had nearly not enough caffeine this morning. On 1620 AM, Radio Sandy Springs, Bill and I are here with our guest, Professor Larry Bottomley, and we were just talking about how Mother Nature is left-handed. What do we mean by that?
Left-handed in with respect to how light interacts with a collection of molecules of that particular compound.
Right.
We can measure the propagation of light through a sample of that material. So we can measure the loss of light intensity. We can also measure the way in which the compound will turn the plane of polarization of the light. For those of you that have Ray-Ban sunglasses, then you're very familiar with a plane polarized light filter.
Right, and if you have a filter that planarizes light in one direction and you take another one and turn it at 90 degrees to it, you filter it all out. And then if it's not quite at 90, you can filter out a select amount.
Right.
But what we're describing here, I think, is the symmetry of molecules. It's very hard to do over the radio, right?
Well,
one
way to think of it is, it's very complicated to look at how you figure out if something's considered left-hand or right-hand. But think of your left hand and your right hand. So if your left hand is very similar to your right hand. Mm-hmm. If you held up your right hand to a mirror, the image is basically your left hand, but they don't overlap.
Absolutely. That's
so
exactly
that,
how
that's
it works.
The and one of the famous historical examples of how this can be critically important is with thalidomide. So that was a drug to help women not be as nauseated. It still didn't keep them from being cranky.
I'm saying this from personal experience.
No, not my wife.
Honey,
this is not me.
This is Bill talking.
3 o'clock in the morning, go get me some pickles at the Publix over in Tennessee. Okay, sure. But actually, so that drug, it got introduced in Europe, and for a good many women, it had the desired effect, but for too many, they ended up giving birth to children that didn't have arms. They had flippers, and most of them didn't survive childhood and all this. And it turns out they finally figured out that it was the left-hand form of that molecule had the desired effect. The right-hand form in some women would induce this birth defect. So, again, this was right-hand versus left-hand, relatively small molecule, disastrously differing effects on developing teeth.
And the handedness is not literally the way in which the atoms are put together, at least initially. It's by what direction the plane of polarized light is turned.
Rotates, right.
So the L turns it to the left. The R turns it to the right. And it's only after intense study can chemists then assign, hey, this is the arrangement in three-dimensional space
right.
of the atoms.
And sometimes we get very sloppy about that. For example, industrial chemicals, if they have one of these symmetry centers, we oftentimes don't worry about it because sometimes both types, if it's not a biological application, have a similar effect. In biology, because symmetry is very important in enzymes and proteins, all these proteins are made from amino acids that are left-handed, it can be very important. But what we've assumed for many, many years is that the right-handed form is inert, that it just doesn't react, that it won't fit in the enzyme center and do what it's supposed to do. But over the last few decades, we have realized that's not always the case. This is exactly the point with the thalidomide tragedy, that a lot of times it's very difficult to separate the two. So you'll make one that's 50-50, right? Do we call that a racemic mixture?
Yes.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be 50-50.
Right, but the point is we have actually done experiments with collaborators at Emory where we put the right-handed amino acid segment on a surface assuming it's inert, and that's often a good control experiment. But there are actually some amino acids that were sold years ago at these nutrition centers. And they weren't made by some natural product chemistry or extracted. They were made by an industrial process they had the right-handed one in there, and in large concentrations, some people had this neurodegenerative disease. So.
For the average listener, when chemists get together, throw the chemicals in the beaker, create the reaction, in most instances, they get a 50-50 mixture of the L form and the R
right.
form. And a lot of the statements that you're made about the early wisdom in this field was based on the fact that when we isolated the chemical from a natural source, we got a preponderance of the L form over the R form. And so it was just the assumption that the L form must be made preferentially in the body, the L form must be the reactive form of the molecule. As you said, only recently have we learned that the R form is also active and in some organisms is produced selectively, or the ratio of the L to the R is changing.
Yeah, and as Bill said, thalidomide made that point very...
I think for those of you that are getting scared and terrified and just want to go breathe in a vacuum or something like that, actually it was not long after the thalidomide tragedy that the FDA, I believe, check me if I'm wrong, set out regulations that you can't make pharmaceutical products that have a mixture of mm-hmm. left and right hand forms. It must be straight. Is that correct?
Unless you've done the careful testing.
Okay. But they don't just kind of, yeah, it seems to work pretty well. Let's a little of this, a little of that. Let's throw a little oregano in there and see how this works.
The testing of drugs is a subject for another complete show, maybe a complete series
right.
of shows.
Yeah.
Right?
We realize we're just going to sort of scratch the surface here. But, right. but if you are terrified, oh, and we have a question. Before Robin gets to her question, if you have a question, feel free to give us a call at 404-943-1620. And if you're listening online, these numbers are on the website, or toll free at 1-866-356-0789. Robin, you have a question?
Yes. Can you hear me?
No.
Okay. No,
you're
we
not
can't.
On.
All right. Well, my question is that why herbal supplements and the things you can buy in health food stores are... You know, you need to take them very cautiously because of the L form and R form.
So
I've seen on some labels L,
yeah.
lycopene or whatever.
Right,
you know,
right.
L this or L that. Is that, the L means the left
so,
form?
So just in case our listeners can't hear that question, Robin's question is this symmetry important as to, you know, choosing supplements from these nutrition centers? And sometimes you see the L version of something. Larry?
Yes. You mentioned the health food stores. The real difference between the material that you'd buy in a pharmacy versus the same chemical name that you buy in the health food store is going to be the method of preparation, A, and B, the dosage. From the pharmacist, you're likely to get a much purer form of the particular chemical substance than you will from the health food store. Okay?
Sorry.
Okay, so...
that's a great question, because people think it's a health store. Everything must be okay in here at the health store.
Yeah, and the truth
is... I will
is
find no death here in the health
this,
store.
This right-handed health. Amino acid uh-huh. thing was discovered in a health food store because an industrial concern was making it exactly as Professor Bottomley mentioned. They probably got close to a 50-50 mixture and assumed the right-handed form had no effect, which it often does. But in fact, it did have a very bad effect. So we'll continue talking about chemicals in the grocery store when we come back here on Inside the Black Box on 1620 AM.
That's okay.
Pharmaceutical and healthcare needs. Stop.
You are listening to AM 1620 Radio Sandy Springs and RadioSandySprings.com on this Saturday morning. Wanted to mention to you that How Does Your Garden Grow, our gardening show with Master Gardener Pat Thurnell, is coming to you live today at 10 a.m. from Fairies in the Garden at Bullock Hall. Fairies in the Garden is an annual event, annual fundraiser hosted by NFMG, which of course is the North Fulton Massner Gardeners Association. This year the fair is set today from 9 a.m. until 12:30 p.m. In addition to a huge plant sale, there will be a garden-oriented vendors, a garden craft boutique, a raffle and a bake sale, and of course Radio Sandy Springs and our own David Moxley up there live. So we'll invite you to stick around for after the Inside the Black Box for the Master Gardening Hour here on Radio Sandy Springs.
I had one concern about that commercial for a fair tax. The Republicans have just gone too far. They're going to tax us for having affairs now.
And So thank you, Celeste. And let's not forget they're not just
the
gardeners.
The Republicans are gone.
They're not just gardeners, ladies and gentlemen. They're master gardeners. How come we don't have that title in science? How come you're not a master engineer or a master chemist?
I'm working at it.
It's bad public relations.
Right, yeah.
And speaking of bad public relations, let's admit it. The chemical industry, we've probably got the worst public relations there is. And that's what I always say when people get alarmed by these chemical names. There are no bad chemicals, just bad chemical names. To that end, let's turn it over to our guest, Professor Larry Bottomley, who's going to take apart just some basic chemical ingredients.
All right. Picture yourself on the salt and pepper aisle in the grocery store, and you reach for this box of kosher salt, and you're brave and you want to be convinced that this is truly a pure chemical, and so you pick it up and read the label. I did this last night. It says
you need to get
salt.
Out more. That's all I'm going to say here.
Sodium chloride, parentheses, a tiny amount of yellow prussiate of soda is added. Why? Well, it's to keep the material free-flowing through the shaker, just like Grandma used to use
rice
in the salt shaker.
So it absorbs water? Is that what this does?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So yellow prussiate of soda is also known to the chemist as sodium ferrocyanide. That's a molecule, a chemical with an iron atom surrounded by six carbon atoms that have a single nitrogen atom attached to each carbon. Confused yet? For those of you that have heard me read the chemical name sodium ferrocyanide, your probable reaction was, cyanide? In kosher salt? No, the local rabbi who blessed this salt isn't trying to kill you.
Are you sure about that?
The rabbi Jim Jones.
Yeah. While your life expectancy drops to a matter of minutes if you ingest hydrogen cyanide, sodium ferrocyanide passes through the digestive system quite uneventfully and out into that porcelain receptacle found in every home in the city.
All right, we believe we may have a caller with a question. And we're sorting through technical difficulties as
they're calling in from the European Space Station.
Because we're big in Patagonia.
We're trying to, you know, our people are working on getting into nearby Tierra
right,
del
so
Fuego.
If we accidentally cut this person off, please give us a call back.
We're unaccustomed to anybody actually calling in. So
you know, that's a very good point. So, you know, you hear cyanide and you think horrible things. But in fact, super glue is cyanoacrylate as well, and I know people deal with that on their face. Okay. All right. So who is this person? Harmon?
Harmon,
if you hear us, give us a call back. I don't know what happened. I'm sure it had something to do with solar flare activity. that's what scientists do. We blaze it on natural phenomena.
The sunspots. Yes.
So, and another thing you mentioned before, sucralose, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that we chlorinated this. And, you know, chlorine sounds really bad, but you pointed out that chloride or even hydrochloric acid occurs in the human body. We have this all over the place. We do have a caller. So, Harmon, are you there?
Apparently not. Apparently he has too many chemicals.
We're still trying to reach you, Harmon. Harmon, are you there? Hello?
No.
No, okay.
It's one of the individuals around this table. As an electrical engineer, this should be a problem we can solve shortly.
Right, we're blaming it all on Bill. Okay. We'll see if we can address this during the break. But you mentioned before that sucralose is essentially table sugar, sucrose, that's chlorinated.
Yes.
Right? That it sounds really bad. And I was reading something when I was doing a little research on sucralose that, you know, someone mentioned that, it's chlorinated sucrose and chlorine is used in pesticides and it's really bad and it's like putting pesticides in your sweetener. No. Right? Would that be a fair thing to say?
Polyvinyl chloride, that's the material from which the plastic pipe through which all of our drinking water flows. And
you hear people call it PVC.
Yes.
Right. And they're very afraid of it. And that's a good point. So Larry made the point before that the form of the chemical can be very telling as to whether or not it's harmful. So polyvinyl chloride, you not only get your drinking water from it, they actually plasticize it, make that clear, flexible tubing. They actually put that right in your body, catheters, IVs, things like that.
Yes.
So polyvinyl chloride, provided you don't heat it to near 90, 100 degrees C where it starts to give off hydrogen chloride, is perfectly inert. We've used it for decades and haven't had any real problems with it. And
that's biocompatible.
How we discover problems, right? So thalidomide, the biggest problems we discover are boo-boos. Vinyl chloride, on the other hand.
Say that's a boo-boo.
Well, we don't want to defame the scientific community here. Let's just call it a boo-boo.
Thank you.
So one of the best boo-boos was vinyl chloride. So, for example, for years, a lot of these sweeteners, people have claimed cyclamate, sodium saccharide, cause cancer. And we never really saw evidence for that. We fed 9,000 times the normal dosage to rats, and some of them got cancer, and we're not really sure. Vinyl chloride, if you actually buy the gas from a chemical company, because we did some experiments on this, is the only thing that actually says, it doesn't say causes cancer in rats, it says causes cancer in humans. That one we figured out from exposure in plants.
But vinyl chloride is significantly different than polyvinyl chloride.
That's the whole point.
Right.
Right. So many of the...
Poly is Greek for many.
Right, exactly. So basically you take one molecule and you react it to connect it to another molecule and do that over and over again. And most of the polymers you deal with, the molecules are so big and relatively unreactive that they are completely safe. But you take, for example, polystyrene. Polystyrene is in consumer products. If you do model airplanes,
I used to date a girl named Polystyrene.
You did? You have a very strange dating life.
Yes, I do.
But you told that story about picking up girls at the
Copley
Hotel.
Yeah, we don't need to read
But the point is, styrene by itself actually is a pretty toxic chemical. But polystyrene, you use it all the time. So that's one of the take-home.
But you don't eat it.
Right. This is true. Unless you're my six-year-old son, Dylan, who consumes it on a regular basis. So that's one of our take-home messages from today. Hopefully that the exact form of that chemical is important. And we'll continue discussing these issues about chemistry in the grocery store on Inside the Black Box on 1620 AM Radio Sandy Springs. Welcome back to Inside the Black Box on Radio Sandy Springs. We're trying to circumvent some technical problems. Do we have Harmon on the line?
Yeah.
All right. Can you hear that, Robin? So, Harmon, what's your question?
I noticed earlier you were talking about left side and right side of molecules and how certain ones are bad, certain ones are good. Mm-hmm. Isn't it, I believe it's Tylenol. It's actually all it's like all right sides. It's completely inert to the body, but your body metabolizes it and changes it to the left. Isn't some drugs that way?
Yes, that is. That's correct.
That's cool.
That's a very common thing. You can switch one to the other literally by just heating chemicals or treating them chemically.
But he's saying enzymatically.
Not L to R. That's cis to trans. The different isomers rather than...
So how does it convert acetaminophen to its other symmetric?
Enzymatically. It has to break bonds and reform the bond.
Ah, okay. So why don't they just give it the original form, the L form?
I don't have a good answer for that. My suspicion is the difficulty in synthesizing and isolating.
Okay. Or could it be that it's not a stability issue?
No.
Okay. Okay. Well, so there you have it.
Thanks for your question.
Yeah.
Good question, Harmon.
Could we hear Harmon on the air? Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That's excellent. So one final thing I want to mention is that a lot of times when you read the label on something, the active ingredients are only a small fraction of those things. So, for example, toothpaste is an example. Sodium fluoride is the anti-cavity ingredient, and it's usually there in a fraction of 1%. Triclosan is often used as an anti-gingivitis thing, and if you use that sensitive teeth stuff, potassium nitrate, which is actually saltpeter. Mm-hmm. So apparently it does desensitize teeth, if not working on the sailors of old. And if you look at the rest of them, most of them are things like cellulose gum to thicken things, carrageenan to do the same thing, things like sodium lauryl sulfate, which is just detergent, and sodium hydroxide, which adjusts the pH. So you might want to keep that in mind. All these nasty sounding things simply just make a paste to carry the active ingredients.
As my wife, the proverbial southern cook, would say, taste and texture.
Those
are inert ingredients to make it palatable for the consumer.
So, for example, when you see carrageenan and cellulose gum or guar gum, those are nothing but polysaccharides that thicken it. It's the same thing you use cornstarch in to thicken your sauce. It works exactly the same way. So before we conclude here, we at least want to tell you where you can get some more information about chemicals and chemistry.
Okay, I would recommend going to the library, looking for the Merck Index. It has a very nice description.
M-E-R-C-K.
As in the Merck Pharmaceutical Corporation.
Exactly.
Right.
And there are several editions of this book. It is a wealth of information. It will tell you about the chemical reactivity, the toxicity, the metabolites, etc. There's also the web, and a website that I would really recommend is from Professor Joe Schwartz at McGill University in Toronto. He has a distinguished career in translating chemistry for the common man. Your local pharmacist is an expert in chemistry, in chemicals, and their interactions in the body. So what do you want to do if you don't have time to go to these places, and nor do you have time to get a PhD in chemistry? Well, I also recommend the book Napoleon's Buttons, How 17 Molecules Changed History. This is written by Dr. Penny LeContour and Jay Burleson. Dr. LeContour is the Dean of Arts and Sciences at Capilano College. She's taught chemistry for the past 36 years. It's a wonderful read. It's intended for the common man. It teaches you just enough about chemistry to appreciate the fine print.
So by common man, we mean people that are not chemically inclined, or as Bill and I like to call them, normal people?
Yes.
Is that safe to say? And we do have a link to Napoleon's Buttons on the website, so if you go to this particular show that's linked to the Radio Sandy Springs site, plus some other websites on food additives with the FDA, the Science in the Public Interest site on those things. We don't have Schwartz's site up there. I know I promised I'd get you up there last night, but I will put that up later today. Mm-hmm. So by all means, check out those.
I've got to buy a copy of this book. Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it looks good. And the nice thing is I tried to buy it last night at Borders. They were out. But it is available in paperback, and it's just $10 or a little bit more, depending on where you buy it.
Right.
And it's is it safe to say it's written at the level that you don't have to have a degree in chemistry to understand it?
It's written at the high school level.
Right.
So, and it covers topics all the way from the birth control pill to the wonder drugs, the textile dyes, silk, nitro compounds, cellulose, glucose, ascorbic acid, all of the spices that you purchase in the grocery store. And a number of other things.
Okay, so before we wrap up, I'm looking at Celeste. She's trying to tweak some. We're going here. We're rolling. Any other lessons for the average person? I mean, and stuff that you could put into a simple rule of thumb, or as us engineers like to call it, a design heuristic.
It's very straightforward. Read the fine print. Don't react until you've investigated the structure and reactivity.
Mm-hmm.
And then remember, dosage matters.
Right.
Right?
Right. One person's negligible effect is another person's right. effective drug is another person's poison, depending on what the dosage is.
Right.
Exactly. I guess with regard to the information we talked about before, when you read these things, go out onto the web. Admittedly, over the last 10 years, this is a very valuable resource. And it's exactly what I have to do, by the way, because I don't know these things as well. I was looking through my Diet Publix root beer, which I drink on a regular basis, and I had to go.
We didn't
to the
need
web.
To know that about you, Pete.
Oh, okay. Okay, which I didn't know had all sorts of things in it. Like, for example, that's where I learned about sucralose, and is it acesulfame? Acesulfame? I don't think it's an acetic acid derivative, so I'm not sure where that comes from. This is actually a sweetener, I believe, originally developed in Germany. That is not only used as a sweetener, but is used to enhance sweeteners like saccharin and sucralose and things like this. And yes, this is in the book.
Yes.
And by looking at these things, they're common names, they're trade names. If you see Splenda, that is sucralose. And unless you work in the industry, you don't know what it is. So go to the web and look for references to places like the Merck Index, which I think is very well-characterized stuff. So are we wrapping up, or are we? Okay, we're wrapping up. So, ladies and gentlemen, I think this is just our first foray into the chemical world, where
much
we just
more.
Sort of scratched the surface, and hopefully we'll have Professor Bottomley back for another show or two
and
to talk about this.
And thank you for coming by.
It's been a pleasure, guys.
And once again, you've been listening to Inside the Black Box on 1620 AM, web and podcasting at RadioSandySprings.com.